Thank you.
So,
yeah.
I think we'll go ahead and get started, if that's all right, if you all just want to take your seats. So I'm very pleased to have up on stage Mr. Tom Staggs, Chief Financial Officer of the Walt Disney Corporation. Tom, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Before I get started, Disney's asked me to make a quick comment. For any forward-looking disclaimer language, please see the Walt Disney Corporation website. And with that, Tom, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
I guess what we'll probably do is I'll ask a few questions, then we'll turn it over to the audience. But before I get started, are there any kind of introductory comments that you'd like to make for the group?
Sure. I think that the backdrop really for us is that as we move along, we're pleased with the way that performance has been going, and that's continued. 2005 turned out well, double-digit growth again, and very strong cash flow and continued improvement in capital returns, just what we set out to do. And we see nice momentum as we go into, because we have a September year end, so as we go into the second quarter, if we look back, the parks had a great holiday season. We actually set a record at Walt Disney World for the holiday period in terms of attendance. So that was nice after a little bit of a slow start due to the hurricanes at the beginning of the quarter. We really had a nice end to the quarter. Disneyland continues to knock the cover off the ball for the 50th anniversary, so that's great. Hong Kong Disneyland is ramping up extremely well, and the guest satisfaction ratings there are, even better than we would have hoped. So, and whenever we see the product resonating that well, it really bodes well for the future. It seems like people watch the opening of the theme park as if it was the opening of a film. It's kind of a different thing. It's just a 40 or 50 year asset, but the early returns in terms of guest satisfaction and certainly how it ramped up over the holidays look pretty good. So that feels good. Obviously, we're pleased with Narnia, which looks like it's on its way to doing something in the $300 million kind of category. So domestically, and it's doing equally well internationally, and so that's good. And the ad market's held up well. Had high single-digit kind of ad sales at the network above the upfront levels, and the ESPN has also seen a nice ad market. Obviously, had a fantastic week with the bowl games, with some of the highest ratings we've seen in years there. And so, the base business all looks great. And when we step back at it and look at it, we feel like it's really driven by the success of a lot of content, and we think that's going to be critical for us. When we look at the marketplace today, and I was just out at CES in Las Vegas, and it was kind of amazing to see the array of devices, many, many of them. Everything's got a video screen now, by the way. It's from, in the cars to the watches to, and if you never knew you had to have a 102-inch high-def plasma screen, but if you go there, you suddenly have to have one. And then you look at the content that they're throwing up to help market all these things, and invariably, if it's about high def, it's ESPN. If it's about family content, it's Disney, and it's a great reminder that content is what's going to flow over these devices. And so, the work that we've been doing, the stuff that Bob has really been spearheading to embrace technology and really drive it throughout the organization, and take advantage of these new platforms, while remaining platform agnostic, we think really bodes well for the future. Long-winded opening comments, but we like where we sit, and we actually like where the market is going. So
very good, very good. Well, let me just maybe start with a senior management question, because I guess probably the biggest thing that's happened at Disney, over the last year, certainly, I guess, Mr. Eisner was CEO for 20 plus years. Mr. Iger, I guess, certainly around for a while with ABC, since ABC Cap Cities. But given that change in CEO, is there anything that you can share with the audience that you've picked up internally about potential changes in strategic direction in terms of where Disney will be headed, over the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, you raise a good point that Bob Iger's been in the president role for a number of years prior to taking over as CEO, and so that gives us a nice continuity, actually, in the transition. But any company that has had a long-standing CEO that is in the process of changing their CEO has an opportunity to sort of, people will naturally step back and take a look and say, what's the direction? And so even though the, on the one hand, first of all, Michael actually left the company in very good shape with things moving in the right direction. And on the other hand, you know, we've got this opportunity for people to sort of look to the new direction. And so even though it's not a radical change in strategy, and I don't think you should expect one, we're still very content focused, and we've been talking about the opportunities of technology and the opportunities of international for a while. I think there's a chance to jumpstart that and to accelerate it. Some of the things that Bob's done, really championing the iPod deal and you know, testing the waters in some of these areas, invigorates the organization. And the same thing, we are fundamentally a creative company. It's about the content we create. And you know, as I mentioned at CES, the content had to be there, but the real takeaway for us is the content has to continue to be great, and we have to invest in the creative process and get that right. And so there's an opportunity to really invigorate that and show that we're ready to put capital against great content, and we're doing that. And so there's a real sense of energy around the company. And so I think Bob's doing a good job taking advantage of that sort of natural instinct.
Very good. Maybe if I can just shift gears a little bit to talk about theatrical distribution. I guess, you know, late last year, I think you hinted at potentially collapsing the windows, the release window, so the DVD release date was coincident with the theatrical window. Can you just give us a sense on, you know, we interpret those comments correctly, as you kind of alluded to that, and is it a likely change?
Well, I think, first of all, the comments weren't meant to denigrate the theatrical window, because the fact is the theatrical window is very important, and should remain important. If you look at theatrical films in rough terms, a quarter of the revenue is going to come from theatrical, and 50% of it's going to come from home video, and the remainder will be from the other, generally the television windows. So it's a big, important window, and it's the right launching pad for films, and it will likely continue to be for some time. But at the same time, you've seen the gap between the theatrical release and the home video release compress somewhat, and I think that it's probably going to continue, but in fairness, what we're doing is following the consumer, and that is central to what we as a company think we need to focus on. You know, we've all seen what happens when you sort of ignore what the consumer is saying in terms of how and when they want to consume content. And so we need to make sure that we're making content available in windows that make sense to the consumer and maximize the opportunity there. At the same time, you know, we put Chicken Little out on 100 screens with a true 3D experience, and that resonated extremely well with people. Those screens had easily the highest per screen averages. We got great feedback on that, and so there are. We have to make sure that we're putting on great products, that the theatrical experience is all that it can be, and that takes work both from the side of the folks creating the content and from the theater owners, and that'll be a robust window for time to come. And we're not predicting day and date's going to happen tomorrow for, you know, the majority of films, or even pushing for that to happen. But what we will do is experiment with what works with consumers, and we're not going to be afraid of trying to make sure that we're doing what we can to maximize the consumer experience and therefore the value of our content, even if it means bucking convention a little bit in terms of how things have been done in the past.
Understood. That's helpful. I guess sticking with the studio, I think that you gave some indication that during 06 and 07 that you would potentially reduce the number of releases, movie releases, and I guess when you made that decision, was the intent to kind of disinvest and commit less capital to that business given the lower returns in that business versus some of the others? Or is it really more an intent to just reduce the amount of, I'll call it, excess supply in the business?
Well, I think the best way to characterize it would be that we're trying to make sure that we're focusing our investments in the places where we think there's the best chance for great returns. And if you look over the last even 10 years, that our Disney-branded live-action releases have easily outpaced the industry and outpaced our own non-Disney live-action releases in terms of returns and profitability. And so given that, we think that having greater than 50%, and if you take the 2006 film slate as an example, for Touchstone and Disney, we'll put 70% of our investment towards Disney-branded film. We'll put a little bit, much less than we did before, but a little bit towards the Miramax properties. And that's the principal place where we've reduced investment in the last year. So the number of releases will come down some because we don't have nearly the volume of Miramax titles coming out. And we think that that is a good balance. I mean, the creative process for us seems to work best when there's a relative scarcity of capital, meaning that our filmmakers, and we've got great filmmakers, but when they've got to focus on the projects they believe in most, when we focus those projects on Disney-branded titles, those are the titles that resonate throughout the organization. And they told me they'd be two big giant screens, so I know this is just a Q&A, but I couldn't resist bringing one teaser to sort of, as it, but it's to make my point. Yes, it's to sell tickets, fair enough, but to make my point, I just want you to take a look at the latest work that we've done on Pirates. It's really just a teaser piece, but if you can run that, that'd be great.
Yeah.
A debt to pay. You owe Davy Jones your soul, not with your demon. You're a marked man, Jake Sparrow.
Nothing more than an almost innocent bystander.
We'll be able to talk your way out of this one.
Jack Sparrow is a dying breed. Jack must find a place in the new world or perish.
What about Jack? I can't live without him. Never mind, let's go.
Share with the audience maybe what you think has kind of maybe gone off track in terms of the development of kind of great, you know, animation features historically, and what specifically you're doing to kind of correct that going forward. So I think you've said that this is one of your, you know, priorities, I think, for 06 and beyond.
Yeah, animation is absolutely one of our priorities, and it is one of the, you know, sweet spots of the company. It's the core, one of the core creative efforts of the company, and one that we intend to invest in, both in terms of people and in terms of putting capital against it. Chicken Little was a very nice first step in the direction of reigniting the animation business. We're not all the way there, but I think it demonstrates that technologically, from a look and feel standpoint, we can take care of that part of the equation. And from the filmmaking side, if history is any guide, we'll do all right there. But it is something that we've got room for improvement. You know, I was at Disney. I've been at Disney a while, but back in 1996, people talked as though, you know, every film we put out was going to be another Lion King, and of course, that was not right. And nor is it right to think that because we had a run of films that weren't quite as successful, it was going to suddenly we just weren't going to be able to make successful films in the future. But the process didn't warrant the result that, or didn't produce the result that we had hoped for or that we wanted. We've made some changes. We've got some new folks in there. All of our products in production right now are CGI films, and you know, we're excited about where we're taking it. But we know there's work to do, and we know it's a place that we need to focus and that we have to get right.
Okay. Shifting over to the parks business, I guess I think a lot of the investors in this room have always kind of expressed skepticism to me when I've met with them about the capital intensity of the parks business. And when you look internationally, it seems like you've taken a very different financial approach to some of those investments by attracting third-party investment. Has there ever been any thought on the domestic parks here in the U.S. of getting some sort of sponsorship that would kind of remove the capital from your books, and then you would kind of enter some sort of leasing model or something that would still allow you to keep the strategic benefits of the parks and perhaps capture a royalty but not have as much of the capital intensity associated with the business?
Well, we've looked at using third-party capital, and obviously we've done it internationally. But let me come back to that in a second, because one of the things that I'm not sure is fully appreciated about the theme parks is the degree to which we really have created an asset there where we enjoy a substantial competitive advantage. If we look at whatever indicators we can see, as even if you go back and look from 9/11 during a downturn, and now we've had a substantial recovery, we've actually built share during that period of time from all measures we can look at, and at the same time, we are not subjected to having to put quite the level of discounting that some of the competitors have had to do. We also have an asset base that I think we can leverage in unique ways. The pricing plan we put in last year really encourages greater length of stay, brings people on our property for a longer period of time, and allows us to capture a greater share of the vacation dollar. So while, you know, and by the way, our capital needs have come down considerably since we've really largely completed the build out domestically of our parks business. So we'll still invest meaningfully under $1 billion a year, and after that investment, we'll deliver $1 billion or so a year in free cash flow after tax from the business. And I think we can deliver attractive growth, not, you know, raging growth, but I think attractive growth going forward. There's still a lot there in terms of asset utilization that we can mine. So now, to the extent that we were able to access someone else's balance sheet, someone else's capital, at a lower cost of capital and increase returns without sacrificing too much profitability for our investor base, we'd certainly be open-minded, and we look at those things from time to time. So far, we haven't, nor has anybody else, ever bring us a structure that really cracks the code, whether it's from a tax problem issue, because we obviously in a lot of those assets have low tax bases, or from a true lower cost of capital standpoint, because, you know, to believe that you've really accessed a lower cost of capital, you have to have really shifted the risk of the business. And it's difficult to do that and still maintain the synergies amongst all the businesses that we enjoy. And those synergies are a large measure of what continues to confer the competitive advantage upon the theme parks. So, you know, we're extremely open-minded about that sort of thing. And when we've looked at international parks development, you know, we've done just that. And the structures that we've utilized in the most recently in Hong Kong, that's going to be a great park. It's going to be really meaningful to our business in that region as a whole. We put in about $315 million of capital. We'll collect royalties and management fees. And, of course, we have 43% of the equity. I like that structure quite a lot, and I think that is a good model for future international development. But domestically, with the existing asset base, we have yet to come up with secret sauce that allows us to do both at once.
Fair enough. What about on park margins? I think if you go at least as far back as I went, mid-90s, you know, through 2001, you saw pretty significant EBIT margin expansion on the parks business. And then we saw a pullback, and it looks like it's bottomed, and we saw some modest improvement actually in 2005. Can you just talk about your comfort in achieving that kind of 20% objective that you've laid out, and what are some of the specific levers you're pulling to kind of reduce the cost structure without impacting the experience that I guess your guests enjoy?
I mean, a couple of things really happened that drove some of the margin decline. And one is that we had an overall downturn, and so coming out of that naturally allows us to increase the margin. You saw some of that in 2004. You saw it again in 2005. To a large degree. The other thing that we saw was that it was right about that time that a lot of the development and the build-out that we had done came online and started working its way through the cost structure, and so that had an impact. We've also seen substantial increases in the employee benefits costs, and that piece alone has had a major part of the portion of the impact on margins. Now, on that, we think that there are ways that we can mitigate future increases. I think that employee benefits will still be an area of increasing cost, but we're very comfortable that we have strategies and programs to leverage the employee base in a way that we can continue to provide the exceptional level of guest service while at the same time having a satisfied, motivated employee base. The fact that we put the assets in the ground lead us to believe that there is a greater level of asset utilization and therefore top-line growth that can drive the margin improvement. And I should say that achieving our top-line growth goals, we feel comfortable with, barring some additional downturn, but they are the most important part to where the margins are going to go. As I mentioned, I talked about Magic Your Way and extending people's length of stay. If we have people staying off property, we might capture roughly half of their vacation dollars when they're in Orlando. If we bring them on property, that number goes up like to 70-80%. If we bring them on property and have them using our transportation, it's even higher. And so, the projects that we've undertaken, which fundamentally go to improving the guest experience, also have the ancillary benefit of having people have be more satisfied with their vacation on property. And that is critical to where we're taking the business. But we don't have a huge amount of capital needs going forward on a relative basis. We've got, and therefore we don't have, big increases in sort of the number of employees that we need to support, greater folks coming through on property. And so you've got a leverageable business model. And that's why we're comfortable with the steady increase in the margins that we've laid out as our goal.
So is it, based on your comments, is it a fair implication that if you don't hit the revenue targets and you won't hit the EBITDA margin improvement at the same time, either we're going to kind of get both or get neither?
Well, we wouldn't be doing it the same way. I think that it's difficult if we're not successful. I think we're going to be successful on the revenue side, but to the extent we saw another downturn, for instance, I think that would have an impact on margins. At the same time, as we've seen, we recover from those things, and the resilience of the business is intact, and the differentiation of a Disney vacation is intact. We've also got some nice flanker businesses, we call them flanker businesses, that on an overall parks basis look like high-margin businesses that can help us. Cruise Line is one of them. We tested last year and are rolling out more broadly this year a vacation project, vacation concept called Adventures by Disney, which is essentially guided tours, but with a Disney element of storytelling and guest service, et cetera. We did Yellowstone and Hawaii last year, and the results were really quite exceptional. The guest satisfaction was very high. People were really thrilled with it. And that's a nice business for us to put out there. I'm not saying it's going to be a giant business, but it's another place for people to have a Disney vacation experience in between theme park visits. Roughly half the people that go down to Florida from a domestic tourist standpoint are going to return, but it's going to take a few years for them to return. Many of them sort of say, well, gee, we wish had another type of Disney experience to have, so here's that opportunity.
Let me just hit on maybe a few other kind of other businesses that may not be enormous, but nonetheless interesting. Hispanics are probably one of the faster growing demographic segments of the U.S. population. I was wondering if you could just elaborate a little bit on kind of Disney's Hispanic strategy, kind of, you know, where was it, where is it today, and what should we look for going forward?
You know, it's something that I guess we haven't given a lot of airtime to, but it's something we're very serious about and spending a lot of time on. Hispanics will make up 15% to 20% of the U.S. population by 2009, and so that's going to be a big part of our market segment. The really good news is that the Disney brand and the Disney properties resonate extremely well with the Hispanic population. So they're at least as strong or stronger than the population as a whole in terms of Disney brand affinity. So there's a real opportunity for us there. And so a lot of our marketing efforts at the theme parks, we're trying to make sure that we're have specific marketing efforts aimed at the Hispanic demographic. Make sure that we've got celebrations specifically aimed at that demographic. And those are resonating quite well, actually. But it goes broader than that. I mean, if you've watched, ABC has actually just gotten a couple of awards and recognition for the diversity that it's pursued, both in front of and behind the camera. If you look at all of our major hit shows right now, they've got a diverse cast associated with them, Desperate Housewives, Lost, Grey's Anatomy. And that Disney Channel, same way, with some of our most popular shows. That's So Raven has been a big hit for the Disney Channel in terms of broad-based audience, but especially for the African-American population. And so making sure that we are reflecting the culture in the programming and in the content, and then specifically marketing it, that content and products to those demographics, is a big part of what we do and a big opportunity for us. By the way, if you look at the Hispanic population in terms of their economic purchasing power, they actually over-index on entertainment. They over-index on movie-going. They over-index on family entertainment. And so it's clearly important demographic for us to get right, but we are really well-positioned and in good shape there. And, it's not exactly to your question, but that's part of the reason that we are so excited about the international opportunity as well. We have a brand, especially Disney, but ESPN to a lesser extent as it grows around the world, but that resonates across cultures around the world. It's a brand that can be positioned in different environments, in different political climates, et cetera, without being a threat. In fact, it's pro-family and welcomed in most environments. And so I think Disney can position itself and take advantage of growth in international markets more readily than most other entertainment properties. And so a lot of that positioning we're doing now, it's not going to move the needle in the next couple of years when you talk about markets like China and India. But if you look at how important markets like Japan have become to us and, of course, Western Europe, it gives you a sense of where that can go, and it can be a very big deal for us.
Maybe in terms of just hitting on a few of their emerging businesses, I think Apple just reported kind of blowout iPod numbers this afternoon. I was wondering if you could just give us kind of the latest update on kind of how Walt Disney is kind of perceiving kind of the success of some of these early agreements you struck with Apple regarding some of your content, and what sort of collateral implications that agreement has had on other parts of the company, either good or bad.
Well, I mean, that's an important piece of the puzzle, because we've had roughly 1.5 million downloads from the video iPod, and Lost continues to be the biggest piece of that, although this last week, the Rose Bowl highlights were the biggest download. I think the biggest download for iPod in general, certainly for us, but I think for the video iPod overall. And so while 1.5 million downloads doesn't suddenly move the needle in terms of the overall revenue picture for the company, It is something that it wakes up the industry to a certain extent to, you know, these other platforms and the ability to repurpose programming to extend the platforms of programming. We've done a lot with Lost as an example, not just in the video downloads of the episodes, but in terms of being out there in the blogging community and putting supplemental content out there available over mobile devices or over the internet. And that's really about capturing the tremendous community around those properties, because the next phase for broadcast networks especially, but all programmers, is to better capture the time and community around the hit shows. And the internet provides an opportunity to do that in ways that we never had before. We always used to talk 20 years ago about the water cooler effect. And networks didn't get paid for the water cooler effect unless it made people go watch back at home. But now there's an opportunity for that water cooler effect. Nobody has water coolers anymore, but they have internet, and they have mobile devices, and they have, and there's advertising opportunities that go with it. But people are prepared to spend considerable time around these hits, these things that help define culture in our world. And these devices are the thing that connect people with each other to have that discourse, and then the content provider with those audiences in ways that we haven't before. And I won't sit here today and predict exactly what the business model is, but the iPod deal and things like it have the at least our organization pretty excited about the prospects, as opposed to fearful about how it might disrupt existing modes of doing business. And so from that standpoint, it's a very big deal. And you know, we put it out there, and the first question we got was, well, gee, won't this erode audiences? It's obviously early to say. From all I can see, it looks like it can only help build audiences. It's another opportunity for people to access the content, to get into that, if a show like Lost, Addiction, or Desperate Housewives, and become part of an audience that comes back in many different ways and through many different opportunities. And so that's a big deal to us, and I think that's why you're seeing our company, perhaps at least as much as any other content company, be aggressive about really trying to plumb the depths of what can we do with this relationship that consumers are asking for with our content.
Very helpful. I think with that, we'll turn it over to audience questions. If you have a question, just raise your hand and we'll get you a mic.
What are the limiting factors to rolling out more content to either Apple or online partners like Google and Yahoo? And how do you manage your broadcast affiliates as you do such heavy editing problems with that?
Well, the obviously, our relationship with our broadcast affiliates is very important, and it's going to continue to be important for a long time. As I said before, I think the early returns are that making the content available through these other platforms is actually enhancing the television experience. We'll want to keep our eye on that and try to make sure that we are, you know, serving all the masters well. But I think that the thing that there's not a lot that keeps us from looking to other platforms and other opportunities like that. We've got digital rights management issues, so we want to make sure that, you know, iPod provides a very robust digital rights management. The use is well defined, and I think that we know we can't stand and hold back the tide of consumer usage. At the same time, we need to be intelligent about the way we put our properties out there and what the, you know, what the, how we charge for them, and what the business looks like. So, in fairness, there's an element of walking before we run to sort of test the market and understand which resonates, what resonates best with consumers, and what works best in the context of our existing sets of relationships. But at the same time, you're going to see this continue and go forward, and you'll probably see our properties on more platforms going forward, and more of our properties on the platforms that are already out there. You saw us greatly expand what's available on iPod just recently. And, you know, it looks like it's good for the content at the end of the day.
Another question right here in the front.
Some of the investments in the company, the company's made in the past few years have been relatively quiet, but we're relatively loud about some of the costs, the pre-opening in Hong Kong, could you perhaps give us some idea of the scale of a couple business areas that that you're in, where the investments have taken place. One would be consolidated internet activities, what your revenues are, how fast they're ramping, page views, revenues per user, all of that little trivia. And then on the other end, having been to Connecticut to see the investment that's made in HD by ESPN and having come from the show, and it's HD, 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 what the order of magnitude of the pot at the end of the HD rainbow is for the Disney shareholders?
All right. So first, in terms of some of the businesses that we've been pursuing, I mean, you look at our overall internet activities. The best way to think about it is, and it's been growing at double digits. We'll in 2006 pass about $500 million of revenue in internet-based revenue. And I think the best way to think about that is, it's roughly a third, a third, a third between advertising, e-commerce, and paid content. And so that gives you sort of a sense of how that breaks down. We're seeing growth in each of those areas, and we recently purchased a little company, less than $20 million kind of purchase, but called Living Mobile in Europe, and that's about extending our overall mobile licensing business, the paid content business. We started with a thing called Starwave, and now this extends our reach and our content pie quite nicely, especially in a market where those sorts of platforms are well developed and the usage is already going on. So we'd like to continue to expand there. But we're trying to be intelligent about where we place our bets. We're big believers in increasing the overall audience that we capture, especially on some of these new platforms. But we want to make sure that if we acquire audience, that we're acquiring one that's leverageable and sustainable, and one that sort of fits in with the overall set of activities that we're pursuing. So we've perhaps been a little bit more cautious than some in terms of our internet-based acquisition. But I think that we'd be open-minded to pursuing future ones as long as we think we're acquiring leverageable audience or content that we think can expand our sort of amount of must-have properties and our heft as we explore to other platforms. You asked about HD, and that's an area we invested in early, and we built out a new digital facility at ESPN to support it. HD is really about further differentiating the product and the viewing experience. You're right, CES was all about HD. It was kind of amazing what a big deal it was. And the content I think I saw most often was ESPN and HD. I mean, everywhere you turn, that's what people wanted to show off their hardware. For us, it's about continuing to build the ESPN brand. And the important thing about ESPN, we've talked about the fact that we think over the next 5 years, we can grow ESPN's profit at double digits. We feel good about that goal. We feel confident in our ability to meet it. But I think the important thing about ESPN is that it's got an amazing position on traditional television, and it is therefore positioned to do things in other platforms that I don't think anyone else can even think about doing at this point. The relationship that it can strike with its fan base is unique in that world. It's the reason that we're going after the MVNO business. Again, that we're not saying that we have to go out and get 10 million subscribers. This is a business that breaks even at 1.5 million, something like that, subscribers. It's not, but it allows us to solidify that relationship with consumers. And if it works, I think it's also an opportunity to push the envelope in terms of the new ways that we can make content available to people. I mean, with the amount of people that are doing 15-minute downloads of Rose Bowl highlights is a bit of an eye-opener. Perhaps it shouldn't be, because SportsCenter is our most popular program on ESPN, and people can't get enough of that. But we've said for the last couple of years that technology enables us to reach a new set of consumers in new ways at new times in their life. And what we need to do is make sure that we're leveraging the existing platforms that we have, the existing audiences that we have, into those new areas. And that's, we don't make a big splash about a lot of the investments we go pursue in that regard, but that's at the core of what we're trying to do. represents about 25% growth.
Can you, this time of year it's easy to focus on the verge of new technologies, but can you talk a little bit about the next 12 to 18 months for Disney? Is this going to be marked as sort of what saved Disney was actually the travel industry, not so much as other big media companies struggle with this transition at ESPN and you know, Walt Disney World, are really what's going to keep Disney from being exactly like everybody else? With the Super Bowl ads down year over year, it doesn't look like the traditional media business or the film business are really getting better anytime soon. And while all these new technologies are wonderful and they're coming, the reality is they're not going to be big drivers over the next year and a half. So can you just talk a little bit about the mainstay of Disney?
I think there's a couple of points in there, at least. But on the one hand, I think it's right to point out that the theme parks are an interestingly insulated business from the standpoint of technological change. And we don't spend a lot of time, even though we put a lot of technology into theme parks to make sure that the rides are continuing to wow our guests, that business is, the competitive advantage there is well insulated, and I think, you know, we'll continue to see that business post nice gains out in the future. ESPN is similarly has a significant moat around it from the standpoint of the programming it commands, the long-term affiliate deals it commands, and it's just really well positioned to continue to do well. But I think that the rest of the media businesses, there's more going on than perhaps just the environment. And I think it's important that we not confuse, by the way, your point that over the next 12 or 18 months, these new technologies won't necessarily have a giant impact. I actually concur with that. I think that these are the early days right now, and the iPod is not going to suddenly move the needle, and HD isn't suddenly going to move the needle. And high-def DVD, Blu-ray probably won't suddenly move the needle in the next 12 months either. But you are going to see business models change, but we have to be careful not to let the change in business models be confused with a fundamental change in the value of the underlying content that's being sold to those distribution mechanisms. I think business models will change, and I think advertising shares will shift around some. They're already shifting around some. Super Bowl, by the way, is going quite well in terms of sales, so I'm not so sure about that comment, but we're feeling pretty good about that. And I look at the ad market, and I mentioned earlier that we're up high single digits in terms of above the upfront for ABC. So, while I think that it's really incumbent upon us to take the popularity of the shows within those platforms and leverage them into positions in new media, it's a little early to say that it's moribund out there. You'll see nice growth out of media networks, including ESPN, but certainly on the broadcasting side, out of Disney this year, see nice growth in the theme parks, and we've also got a consumer products business that I think is well positioned, provided we continue to make great content. So I actually feel pretty good about this near to medium term, and I think that what we're talking about, and we've talked a lot about today, is positioning for taking advantage of the longer term, because what we're talking about is growing markets on a global basis and growing markets from the standpoint of ability to reach consumers. And that bodes well. The one takeaway from CES, I alluded to it, is that those platforms, that hardware, requires good content to be on it. I think Yahoo's doing some very smart things, because I think they're figuring out that user-created content is more than just creating the marshalling a bunch of content created by random people, but using the force of the network to help guide people to what content is best. That's going to continue. But a lot of the best content and a lot of the best community is going to continue to be created by companies like Disney. And those phenomena are things that we can participate in as well.
We have time maybe for one more question.
One thing you don't
talk very much about is you have hard interest in, I'm not even sure how many cable networks that are not consolidated. I know they are reported in the equity and earnings, so it would be helpful if I had a better understanding of exactly what you did own. Did they contribute anything to earnings last year? And is there any opportunity that you can see over time to rationalize those investments to take better advantage of the franchises and maybe at some point bring them into EBITDA as well?
Yeah, we actually literally within the last 10 days filed an 8K. We're gonna take the equity and affiliates and move it up into the segment operating income because that's how we manage the business, and we think it's the best way to report it. We'll continue to provide you some ancillary information so you can track what that is. But to your exactly to that point, that's how we think about those businesses. But you know, the major businesses that we have that we hold on a partial basis and that have formerly been in the equity and affiliates line are Lifetime, where we own half, A&E and History, where we own 37.5%, and E, where Comcast is the majority owner, we own around 40% of that asset. And they do contribute overall to our earnings quite nicely, several hundred million dollars. We have some other smaller ones and some international investments. Those are really the major pieces. I think that the strategic direction for us would be towards rationalization of that ownership so we can leverage those properties better, but I can't tell you that's going to happen anytime soon. We have some pretty stable partnerships there with some good partners. We've been partners with First on a whole bunch of things, including ESPN, obviously, for a long time. And I think they're quite happy with where things are. And the business has performed relatively well. So the good news is they've been good partners. To the extent that we see an opportunity to sort of better fold that business in or rationalize it in a way that it can become more strategic, we're open to that, certainly, going forward.
Perfect. Well, Tom, thank you very much. Thank you all.
Thank you.